Lowe's knows that no matter your paint project, saving is at the top of your list. That's why when you shop today, you can buy one, get one free select Valspar and HGTV Home by Sherwin-Williams one-coat coverage interior paints via rebate. Shop these deals in-store or online today at Lowe's. We help, you save. Selection varies by location. While supplies last. Discount taken at time of purchase. See sales associate for details. Offer valid 8/21 through 9/3.
Nobody has more respect for women than I do. Nobody.
Hillary Clinton wants to abolish it. Believe me. She wants to abolish our Second Amendment.
I think they didn't deny it. I don't think anybody denied it.
Other presidents did not call, did write letters, and some presidents didn't do anything.
Many people have come out and said, I'm right.
You really do have to ask yourself, where does it stop?
Hello and welcome to Fallacious Trump, the podcast where we use the insane ramblings of the kiddie fiddler on the roof to explain logical fallacies. I'm your host, Jim.
And I'm your other host, Mark. A logical fallacy is an error in reasoning that results in bad or invalid arguments. And the logical fallacy we're looking at this week is the ethnocentric fallacy. Does kiddie fiddler translate to a US audience?
I don't know, actually, because I have seen a lot of people saying diddler on the roof, which may be more American-centric.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's I couldn't understand why no one was using the obvious fiddler on
the roof. The obvious reference. One, kiddie fiddler on the roof.
So the ethnocentric fallacy.
Yeah.
This isn't specifically racism, although racism is a factor in people who are using this fallacy, because basically it's about favoring your own group, be that an ethnic group, a racial group, people in your nation, or some other definition of group, basically, over others. And that's where your reasoning starts for something.
Mm-hmm.
I found this one in a book that we've looked at before, David Hackett Fisher's book about historical fallacies, Towards a Logic of Historical Thought. We looked at the furtive fallacy came from this one as well. Here is David Hackett Fisher's definition of this fallacy. He says, the fallacy of ethnocentrism is committed by a historian who exaggerates the role of his own group in its interaction with other groups. So basically he's saying that it's when people see their own or the contributions of their own group as more important than others, or more actually important than they historically were.
Right.
And
that's
how it is used, according to him, by historians. And that's where they go wrong sometimes in giving too much weight to their own group. I'm also including the kind of supremacy idea of just, you know, the reasoning starts from the idea that your own group is just better or is right in some way.
Yes.
I was watching Crocodile Dundee for some reason again recently.
Right.
And there's a point at which he gets in a car in New York and says, oh, the steering wheel's on the wrong side.
Mm-hmm.
The idea that it's the wrong side and the way you do it is the right
way
is part of this, essentially.
Yeah.
So for our first example from Trump, we go to a speech that he gave at Mount Rushmore on July 4th, Independence Day, 2020.
Americans harnessed electricity, split the atom, and gave the world the telephone and the internet. We settled the Wild West, won two world wars, landed American astronauts on the moon, and one day, very soon, we will plant our flag on Mars.
There's quite a lot there that he's claiming America is responsible for.
I mean, he's like, the only one that has the kind of the caveat is landed American astronauts on the moon.
Mm. And even then, you've got to ignore the contributions of German scientists, German rocket scientists that were brought over from with Operation Paperclip.
Yes.
Yeah, if you do that, Americans landed American astronauts on the moon. The one I'm happy to give them is settling the Wild West. Yep, go ahead. Genocide. Yeah, that was all you.
Yeah. Tim Berners-Lee, American.
Yeah, the internet. Technically, if you only consider the kind of connecting, ARPANET, essentially, connecting computers together. But how people use the internet, which is the web, was very much Tim Berners-Lee, who's a Brit.
Yeah.
The phone was a Scotsman, Alexander Graham Bell.
Yeah.
I get that there's Bell Telecom now, but he was a Scottish inventor.
Guess what, it's named that, yes.
Yep. He may have moved to America and developed the technology later, but he was a Scot. There's no if you tell a Scot that Americans invented the telephone, Yeah, they will not be happy.
Out to you. Yes, yeah.
Splitting the atom, that was done by a Kiwi, a New Zealander, Ernest Rutherford, in Manchester.
Mm. Yes.
Not Americans at all.
They might have created the bomb, which used that technology.
I mean, maybe that, let's be charitable, maybe that's what he's referring to, but certainly
and
not.
And he's doing Benjamin Franklin flying the kite, harnessing electricity.
Maybe. The other thing is the winning of two world wars.
Yeah, yes.
All of that stuff is giving more weight to your own group than is warranted. The two world wars thing is quite a common one that comes up with Americans and with people in other countries as well, who claim that they were responsible for winning the wars.
Yeah.
Certainly Brits.
Yes, exactly. When England football supporters would famously taunt the German teams with two World Wars and one World Cup.
Absolutely. So there's definitely a feeling in Britain that we won both World Wars.
Yeah.
The Americans helped, sure, but they didn't show up until it was very late in the game.
Until it was nearly done.
We had done a lot by the time the Americans showed up.
Yeah.
The idea that they therefore won ignores all of the contributions of Britain and our allies, our other allies who were involved on various fronts. The front that arguably a more unbiased historian might say was the most responsible was the Russian front.
Oh, there you go. Yeah.
A lot of historians who are not British, American, or Russian credit the Soviets with the bulk of stopping the Nazis. If it wasn't for the Germans having to fight essentially on two fronts in the Second World War, then it would have been significantly easier for them. For World War II, certainly. It's at best more complicated than that. if you want to suggest that America won two world wars, and there will be a lot of people with different views.
Little more nuanced than that,
But those views are largely because of the ethnocentric fallacy, because they are looking at it from the perspective of their own group.
And you can almost see the books that he got shown as a child, you know, that with those kind of the illustrations of how the West was won.
Yeah.
And then that same style would be in this country, that would be Ladybird books. It would be that kind of broad brush, simple, homely illustrations of how America was number one. And it's a bit like the Mr. Chumley Warner's with Harry Enfield's character, where it would open, the little scene would open with the map and a globe spinning, and on the globe, the British Isles is huge. It's the size of America and Russia put together, because that's the view. The kind of it is that ethnocentric imperial view.
Yeah,
it's never been better than under our aegis. And
this is very much where the idea of American exceptionalism comes from.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, Americans, to burst your bubble on this.
I think,
to be fair, the vast majority of our American listeners are already aware that their country has issues and isn't perhaps the shining city on the hill that it's sometimes held up to be. But the very idea that there is something just special, just amazing and different about America that makes it better than everywhere else, greatest country in the world or whatever.
Yeah.
So our second Trump example comes from the dying days of the 90 days to get 90 deals thing.
Yeah.
The complete arbitrary deadline that he and Trump and Peter Navarro came up with after one of the times he announced his tariffs. I can't remember. I don't think
surely,
it was the
surely
first
it's
time.
Another 2 weeks to go on this 90 days, surely.
It may have been the time that he stood in the Rose Garden and announced the different numbers for the different countries, the different percentages of tariffs. And then they started counting
March,
for 90 days. But
April,
He said from then that they would easily be able to do deals with all of the different countries because everyone wanted to do deals. And they would basically guarantee 90 deals in 90 days. And this is coming towards the end of the 90 days. And reporters, unsurprisingly, are asking him
about
whether they're going to hit the 90 deal deadline, knowing full well that at best at this point, they've got two framework agreements and not a single deal has actually been done.
Yeah.
Everyone says, when are you going to sign deals? We don't have to sign deals. We could sign 25 deals right now, Howard, if we wanted. We don't have to sign deals. They have to sign deals with us. They want a piece of our market. We don't want a piece of their market. We don't care about their market. They want a piece of our market. So we can just sit down, and I'll do this at some point over the next 2 weeks, and I'll sit with Howard and Scott and with our great vice president, who has done a really good job. We have some good news to report on a lot of fronts, but JD will be there and Marco, and we're going to sit down and we're going to put very fair numbers down, and we're going to say, here's what this country, what we want, and congratulations, we have a deal. And they'll either say, great, and they'll start shopping, or they'll say, not good, we're not going to do it. I said, that's okay, you don't have to shop.
So I know this isn't relevant, but saying that he's going to sit down with Howard and Scott and JD and Marco really makes it sound like he's in a boy band.
Yeah. It's just... yeah.
So he's gone from, we'll have 90 deals signed in 90 days, to we don't have to sign any deals. We don't care about other countries.
We could do 25 right now.
Yeah. Our country is the best and everyone wants to do deals with us. That's, you know, slightly blown out of the water by the fact that not a single country has done a deal with the US during that time period. But everyone wants
going,
to, obviously.
Fuck that. Yeah.
But yeah, exactly. if what he was saying was true, was that the US doesn't need anything from other countries and everyone needs stuff from the US, he wouldn't need the fucking tariffs. Because the entire point is that America imports too much stuff, according to him, from other countries, and other countries don't import enough stuff from America. So clearly that isn't the issue. Yeah. America desperately needs the stuff from other countries, including stuff you just can't get in America, let alone the electronics that they don't make there. They just don't have the facilities to make, and if they did, they wouldn't have the raw materials to make. So you'd have to import the raw materials. But things like bananas, you can't grow bananas in the US. They don't. Yeah. So they import them from other places. And if you put tariffs on those other places, there isn't an alternative that you can, you know, you can't build your banana factories in California and avoid the tariffs. But the idea is based on the concept that just, you know, why would we want anything from anyone else? We're America. Everyone wants stuff from us.
Like French wine and French cheese. You know, we import, well, it was Liz Truss's thing, you know, we import two-thirds of our cheese from from Europe. And that's terrible. Well, no, it isn't, because our cheese is shit. You know,
Some of our cheese is okay, but no, the French cheese,
exactly.
Can't really put British cheese up against French cheese and expect to win. No.
No, you can make stuff that kind of looks and smells a bit like French cheese, and then you go, but it's not as good as.
There are some quite nice Somerset Brie's.
Yes, true. Yep. And there was that one that was a blue cheese that was.
We've got Stilton. Stilton's the kind of king of blue cheeses, really.
True. Yeah.
Anyway, as much as we can sit and talk about cheese,
and we can.
I mean, second podcast. But anyway, this whole idea that everyone will come to America, and that's why he's absolutely failed, is because that's not people don't want the stuff from America much that they're prepared to do a deal, and neither do they want America's business so much that they're prepared to do deals that don't work out well for them, because. Yep. American importers need that stuff and will continue to buy that stuff, even though they now have to pay the US Treasury a certain amount of money to be able to do it. And also, other countries exist, so they're still doing deals with lots of other countries. So the American part of their market in many countries is a chunk of it, but it isn't necessarily the bulk of the stuff they export.
Yep.
So he's overestimating the impact that his proclamations can have on world business.
Yeah, and nobody in his entourage his cartel is going to disabuse him of that, because he's the emperor with the no clothes, and they'll just go, whatever, yes sir, no sir, three breaks, four sir, for some reason.
Certainly
or
not JD and Marco, they're busy working on their dance moves.
On their Yeah.
And now is the time, I think, for Mark's British Politics Corner.
Well, I think we should start with the current king of ethnocentrism is probably Nigel Farage. And here he is on GB News in September 2024.
Look, I'm very concerned that we have whole areas of our towns and cities that are unrecognisable as being English. But they're not unrecognisable as being English because of skin colour. They're unrecognisable because of culture. I mean, look, you know, the truth is, I genuinely think that the British are the most open-minded, most accepting people, you know, that you'd frankly find, I think, from any Western country. But it's the cultural impact of this. It is the societal impact of this. You know, you look at our cities now, you know, people often don't even know the names of their neighbours. It is the breakdown of communities.
So the British are the most open-minded and most accepting people that you frankly find, I think, from any Western country.
Yeah, that's why we're such lovers of Europe.
Exactly. But and also why we're such xenophobic racists.
Yeah. Or,
you know, which is why he's...
Why he is a public figure.
Yes. Yes. Because, you know, it's the same thing. Frankly, you'd find from any Western country, but it's the equivalent of, I'm not being racist, but.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and the questions that came up for me are, if nobody in the Western civilization is as tolerant and inclusive as the British, so if you're going to come here, you've got to be like that too, or we won't tolerate it. Or,
yeah, I mean, I think this is one way of saying the bloody foreigners aren't as open-minded as we are.
Yeah, because we can't tolerate close-mindedness. Yeah. Is he saying the problem with the societal impact is, you've either got to come here and basically he's saying you've got to come here and fit in. It's not about your skin colour, it's about the culture.
Yeah.
And we'll talk about the other culture worry in a minute. Or if the British are the most accepting in the Western world, why can't they accept people don't need to be British to be in England?
Or that people who have moved here and are living here and happen to enjoy a curry or a, you know, shawarma are British.
Yes, exactly. And also, because we're the most open-minded and accepting, that gives us permission, therefore, nay, the right to determine that if people don't know the names of their neighbours in our cities, then we can determine who can come into our cities. This day and age, and I hate the way, I fucking hate the way he talks. It's almost as irritating as Priti Patel with her ins on the end of ings. Where he drops his voice and he goes, I mean, you know, the truth is, I genuinely think. And then he says that you look at our cities, I mean, you know, you look at our cities now, you know, people often don't even know the names of their neighbours. Well, yeah, because cities are quite big places. How many neighbours do you have to know the names of? How many neighbours does he know the names of?
I live in a village, which I would be pretty confident is about 90% white, probably.
Yeah.
White British birth origin. And I don't know the names of my neighbours because I don't like talking to people. I've lived in one house my entire life where I knew the names of my neighbours, and that's because I lived next to my grandparents once.
Well, there you go. And I only knew the names of that side. The other side, no idea.
Oh, yeah, the other side.
Were.
No, I don't know who they
were. No idea. I know the names of the neighbours either side. I don't know the name of the neighbours over the road. Because the British don't tend to ask each other their names.
No.
You can have entire conversations.
This is the thing, I think, again, focusing on a little bit on our American listeners for a little bit. On my occasional trips to America, I have noticed a significant increase in willingness to talk to strangers. Not on my part, obviously. On strangers' parts. People will get chatting in a like fast food restaurant or on the street sometimes or whatever. That's super fucking weird in England. If you're in London and a person you don't know talks to you, something has happened. There is like a bomb threat or something has happened that has made us start to invoke the Blitz spirit, which is where Brits talk to each other. That's the bit where we start to feel some kind of collective energy in London. Yeah. Otherwise, head down, don't look anyone in the eye, never talk to another person. That's how we do things.
Yeah, or they're Australians.
Yeah.
In France, I find it delightful that everyone says good morning to one another. Uh-huh. I've tried that, and I've come back from France having said bonjour to everybody that you walk past, and you try and say not bonjour because they wouldn't understand. Try and say good morning to people, and they just look at you.
Yeah.
Because you think, oh, yeah, I forgot. I've come across the channel.
There are two instances outside of major terrorist threats that it is acceptable to interact really with strangers. One is if you're walking a dog and you see another person also walking their dog.
Yeah.
Perfectly happy to stop and have a chat with that person for no other reason than just to give the dogs an opportunity to have a little sniff of each other. Secondly, if you see a person on a boat and you're on the shore, it is required to wave at them.
Yes.
Or vice versa. Yes. If you're on the boat and you see another person who isn't on the boat.
It also, if you're a classic car owner, then it's the rule you have to wave at fellow classic car owners, but only the same model.
Yeah, yeah.
You can't just generally. If you're riding a motorbike, however, then you can wave at somebody else. But of course, you're using both your hands. So what you do is wave your foot at another biker. Yeah, because otherwise you've let go of the handlebars, fall off, break your collarbone. Yeah. Don't ask how I know. Yes. Okay. So the second example is, see, I think that this notion of a culture wars, it's interesting the word culture that gets bandied around. And I think it's one of those words that's it's flexibly definable, just like woke is. And I think that being a part of a culture is the thing that is they go to war about. And here's Kemi Badenoch, leader of the Tory party, the right wing, who hails originally from Nigeria, as she was at one time proud to talk about, though latterly she seems to have eschewed that heritage, possibly to appear more British or to appeal to more British. But here she is talking to Laura Kunzberg also in September 2024.
Of course, not all cultures are equally valid. I don't believe in cultural relativism. I believe in Western values, the principles which have made this country great. And I think that we need to make sure that we continue to abide by those principles to keep the society that we have now.
So which particular cultures then would you say are less valid? Because as you've said, your words, not mine, some people think that that is a controversial thing to say. Mm. So which cultures would you specifically say are less valid than others?
So it's not about labelling cultures. Culture includes a lot of things. I'm not talking about cuisine. I'm talking about customs. And I think that cultures where women are told that they should not work, I would knock on doors. You'd knock on doors and you'd see somebody at the door who says, oh, I can't speak to you. I will get my husband. I don't think that's as equally valid as our culture.
Wow.
So she actually says that I don't believe in cultural relativism.
Yeah.
I believe she opens with,
of course, not all cultures are equally valid. Like that's a thing that everyone thinks.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. Everybody agrees. Yeah. Many people have said.
I do love Laura Kunzberg's obvious follow up. I mean, it is the obvious one.
Yeah.
But, all right, then. Rank the cultures for me.
Rank them. Yeah. Say why. Why are they less valid? Yeah. And then, you know, so it's a bit like it's as banal as Farage's. People don't know the name of their neighbours, therefore there goes the neighbourhood. You know, if you knock on the door and say, oh, well, I'll just see if my husband's in, why does that mean that you're not valid? You're less valid because of that. She's a believer in the absolutism of Western values being absolutely the best. Of course, she fails to take into account that the Western values that made this country great, the ones that are more valid than those that are not Western values, are from the part of the world, the West, that at one time held the values that it was okay to forcibly take people from places like Nigeria and sell them into slavery.
Yeah, I can't even figure out what she's talking about because I don't think she's saying the values we have currently in the UK, because she's arguing it's not going brilliantly, right?
Yes.
So it's not that. It's imagined Western values that we had at some point in the past, but not too far in the past, because then you start getting into trouble. There's a very specific apparent... It's basically when America was great again, isn't it? It's that period.
Yeah, yeah.
That imagined period of history when everything was good.
Yes.
It's the hazy sepia 50s time when you could play on the street until midnight and no one cared.
Yeah, you could go out to the theatre and have a four-course meal and buy a pair of hobnail boots and still have change from sixpence. Yeah.
Yeah. It's the amorphous Western values of an imagined time and place.
Exactly. Yes. Which leads us nicely onto the Euro skeptic elephant in the room, which is the ethnocentric fallacy at the heart of the whole Brexit thing, which was predicated on the belief that Britain was the greatest and the our greatness was being taken away by Europe, and therefore we should take it all back again. And here's Boris at a rally of the Leave campaign in the run-up to the referendum in June 2016, telling the gathered throng of Europhobes when Britain is at its best.
I think we should take the chance now, as a country, to take back control. Take back control of huge sums of money. Of huge sums of money, of £350 million a week, and spend it on our priorities. And yes, let us take back control of our borders. I just urge everybody who's come along today to believe in us, believe in ourselves as a country, because this country is at its best when we believe in ourselves. And let us, by the way, speak up for the hundreds of millions of people around Europe who agree with us, but who at the moment have no voice in this debate. This is our cue. This is our chance. This is our moment.
So he's harking back to... the halcyon days of nothing, and all the words you just used, I've written down here too. So he's saying that the country is at its best when it believes that the rest of the world is out to get us and is generally shit, and Britain does everything better than all those shit countries. It's at its best when we believe in some amorphous, nostalgic and non-specific sunlit, green and pleasant land and are willing to believe in a blustering self-service upper-class twit and go along with everything he says without question.
Like we That's used when to we're in at the old best. Days.
Yeah, like we used Thing to is, in the old that, days. That we knew it, our place.
Yeah, absolutely. That part of it, we absolutely did just go along with it, whatever the blustering, self-serving upper-class twit in power said. That is something that he's nostalgically looking back on and thinking,
Johnson took us back to that. He even, when he got voted in for the first time as Prime Minister, did an impression of fucking Winston Churchill when he came out, hunched with his hands in his pockets.
Yes.
And of course, we know that the Brexit, the entire thing was championed by said layabout Boris Johnson in order to further his own career and fulfill his dream of one day being Prime Minister, on the basis that if the system is one that won't accommodate a Machiavellian narcissist to get anywhere near power, then you change the system. And you mobilize disenfranchised xenophobes to make it feel like they're getting something back. And what's more, lionize the person that's spearheading their enfranchisement. Sound familiar, US? Yeah. And for us, didn't it all work out really well?
Nobody knows, is it better? Makes me feel sad for all the rest. Nobody does it half as good as me. Baby, baby, I'm the best. The way that you vote for me, whenever you vote for me, there's some kind of inside me. It keeps you from running, but just keep it coming. How do I learn to do the things I do? Nobody told us it better. Never wish someone could. Nobody does it quite the way I do. Why do I have to be so good? The wild fantasies. Baby, I'm the best.
Radiohead there, featuring an AI Donald J. Trump voice with their cover of Nobody Does It Better.
Excellent. Had to be that. That's great. So the fallacy in the wild, we like to talk about the fallacy of the week from a non-political perspective. And our first example comes from Friends.
Yay.
And this is the London wedding episode.
Aha.
And Ross and Emily's parents are arguing, basically, over expenses for the wedding.
There's no way in hell I'm paying for it.
Look, we're down to just one point.
Could we please maybe just settle it after the wedding?
All right, fine, but I just want to say I'm not paying for your wine cellar. You thieving would be speaking German if it weren't for us cheap little man.
Would be speaking German if it weren't for us.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, I mentioned the whole World War thing,
yep,
and how Americans, yep, love to believe that they won the war.
Yeah,
I could have found many other examples of this on both sides. There's one from Chicken Run where the old kind of soldier English chicken complains about the Yanks turning up late again.
Yeah,
and things like that. So yeah, there's strong feelings on both sides of this argument.
Yeah,
but I kind of had to use the Friends example. So the second example is from My Big Fat Greek Wedding.
Mm-hmm.
This is a flashback to the main character's childhood, and her father is a very, very proud Greek man.
Give me a word. Any word, and I show you how the root of that word is Greek. Okay? How about arachnophobia? Arachna, that comes from the Greek word for spider. And phobia is fear. So fear of spider. There you go.
Okay, Mr. Portocollis, how about the word kimono?
Aha, kimono. Kimono, kimono, kimono. Of course, kimono is come from the Greek word chimona, is mean winter. So what do you wear in the winter time to stay warm? A robe. You see, robe, kimono, there you go.
This is the thing that he likes to do while he's kind of taking the kids to school and that kind of stuff and at the dinner table. Yeah, he can make anything into an originally Greek word. And yeah, as far as he's concerned, the Greek culture is better than every other culture and is kind of responsible for Western civilization as a whole. And that's where he starts from in his reasoning and then builds whatever needs to be built to justify what he already believes.
I loved it when she came up with kimono. I was thinking, oh, yeah, I never thought. I was racking my brain thinking, yeah, come on, quick, think of an example. Yeah, something in Latin. Yeah,
yeah,
that isn't of Greek derivation. And then she just went, kimono. Oh, yeah, brilliant.
Good one. Our final example in this section is from Parks and Recreation, and I don't know why, but like the Friends example, this is the episode where they came to London.
Okay, guys, we are going to be sightseeing today. Andy and Ben are going to go to their meeting, and then we're going to go back to the hotel for lunch, and I will spend the day getting to know London's history.
History began on July 4th, 1776. Everything before that was a mistake.
Yeah, Ron is pretty ethnocentric in his views. He's only kind of reluctantly tagging along.
Casually taking a completely out of focus diagonal shot of Buckingham Palace.
So we're gonna play
fake news, folks. I love the game. It's a great game.
I understand the game as well as anybody. As well as anybody.
Yes, it's time for fake news, the game where I read out three Trump quotes, two of which are real and one I made up, and Mark has to figure out which one is fake news.
Of course, if we were playing the original of this game, the one that's carved on the ancient lion gates in Byzantium, I'd have won all the rounds. As it is, this cheap knockoff local version has all the authenticity and straightness of a spirit level from Wish.com. It leans in a direction not in my favour, is what I'm saying.
I'm not even going to respond to that. The quotes this week come from Trump talking about the attack on Iran, which he's super happy about how that went, even though a lot of reporting since has shown that actually they didn't completely obliterate the Iranian nuclear sites.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's just fake news. Everyone knows that they really did.
Everyone knows. Yeah.
So over the kind of days after, it turned from, we absolutely obliterated them, more into, well, it went very well, the whole mission. It went as planned. And Trump was obviously in the Situation Room watching everything happen.
Yeah.
And it seems that he learned a new word.
Right.
So statement number one,
Mm-hmm.
Those machines flew for 37 straight hours. They didn't stop. They went skedaddle. You know the word skedaddle? It means skedaddle. They dropped the bombs and they... Somebody said, skedaddle, let's get the hell out of here. And every bomb hit its mark and hit it beautifully, hit it incredibly. And as you know, the Atomic Energy Commission said it's gone. That place is gone. We had a lot of fake reporting, mostly from CNN, where the scammer writer, a writer for CNN, who should be fired, by the way, she was involved with the 51 fake intelligence agents, if you remember that. She did that story.
Right. Okay. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
Statement number two continues directly from that. She wrote about Russia too, and she's still at CNN. It's kind of amazing. A lot of people said the hit maybe wasn't so good, but they were beautiful. We obliterated them. Then over the next 2, 3, 4 days, it came out more and more that we were right, but we knew that. I was in the Situation Room listening to the pilots when they dropped them all and then skedaddled. And one of my generals turned to me and said, sir, we obliterated them. All three sites totally gone. The pilots were sad when people said it wasn't perfect because they flew through all the missiles.
Okay. Okay. Yeah.
And statement number three, but the equipment is so good. It's stealth, way up in the air, and it was stealth. And they went right through that, and they sort of, by the time they found out they were there, they were already gone. That was the word skedaddle. Get the hell out of here. But they were right in the most dangerous airspace in the world, and they took those big, beautiful, very fast, they're unbelievable planes. I mean, they've become really beautiful works of art. You know, I always thought they sort of were cool, but now they look better than just cool, don't they, huh? But they dropped the loads, and literally they would hit.
Okay, that's a lot of skedaddling. Okay, and now, see, he stopped himself saying beautiful in the first one, but then he said it in the second one and in the third one. Oh, no, you talk about the planes in the third one. More stealth plainness. They dropped the loads and literally they would hit. See, I think that's more of a... that's one of those twisted, unfinished, meaningless Trump sentences that, let's face it, you could easily write. Oh, God, I've just talked myself out of that. Sir, we obliterated them. All three sites are gone. My gut feeling is the sir, but the other gut feeling is, you know, saying skedaddle 7 times in the same paragraph. Oh, man. Okay, so I... Then also the 2, 3, 4 days is kind of... Yeah, it feels too much. Like he doesn't normally do the rule of three there. Okay, on that basis... And why do I think about it when other people just go, oh, yeah, it's got to be that cause. And then they were always right. So I think number two is the one that you made up. Russia.
And so, the other two,
yeah,
which you're more convinced by?
Well, they're completely unconvincingly, but I really want him to say skedaddle 1,000 times. So I'm going to go for number one.
Okay.
More confident. Yeah.
And number one.
Yeah.
Is real.
No.
Those machines flew for 37 straight hours. They didn't stop. They went skedaddle. You know the word skedaddle? It means skedaddle. They dropped the bombs, and somebody said, skedaddle. Let's get the hell out of here. And every bomb hit its mark and hit it incredibly. And as you know, the Atomic Energy Commission said it's gone. That place is gone. We had a lot of fake reporting, mostly from CNN, where the scammer writer, a writer for CNN, who should be fired, by the way, she was involved with the 51 fake intelligence agents, if you remember that. She did that story.
Jesus Christ, skedaddle, skedaddle.
Skedaddle. Yeah, it means just, skedaddle, apparently.
Yeah, it means skedaddle. And he just wants it to sound like, get out of here. As you know, the Atomic Energy Commission said it's gone. Well, they didn't. They said it's not gone.
Yeah.
But if you say that what they said, if you say, tell the truth, of course, that's fake reporting and you're a scammer writer, you should be fired. First they'll come after the journalist, then they'll come after the judge, and then they come after me, and there will be nobody left to stop them.
Yeah. So, I mean, it feels like, and I think this is weird if this is what happened, but it feels like he was in the Situation Room, perhaps, when it was going on, And one of the pilots, perhaps, having dropped the bombs, said, let's skedaddle, which seems like an unlikely thing for one of the pilots to have said.
Unless he's from a...
But where else is he getting that from?
Yes, unless he's a member of the RAF from the 40s. Yeah, it's
so they would say Scarpa.
Scarpa, let's Scarpa, Skipper. Yes. Right. Righto. Yes, don't understand.
It's a weirdly anachronistic thing for people to say, I think. And like, this is a guy who keeps on going on about what an outdated word groceries is.
Yeah.
But skedaddle, he's like, yeah, you know, this is a thing that everyone knows.
Yeah. So it's something that Steamboat Willie would have had in the script.
Yeah. Okay, it's a word that you expect to hear that kind of cartoon while with someone's legs.
Yeah, exactly. Fred Flintstone walking
absolutely.
Going down the bowling alley. Yes.
Before a friction kicks in and they zoom out of frame.
Exactly. Yeah. Yes.
So yeah, that was true. Well, not true, but you know, he said it.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. But the two are always mutually exclusive.
Yeah.
He said
so
it.
You also
think
that number three is
three.
Real.
Yeah, unbelievably cool planes. Yeah.
And number three is real.
But the equipment is so good, it's stealth, way up in the air, and it was stealth. And they went right through that, and they sort of, by the time they found out they were there, they were already gone. That was the word skedaddle, get the hell out of here. But they were right in the most dangerous airspace in the world, and they took those big, beautiful, very fast. They're unbelievable planes. I mean, they become really beautiful works of art. You know, I always thought they sort of were cool, but now they look better than just cool, don't they, huh? But they dropped the loads, and literally they would hit.
It's just, it puts me in mind of the idiot one in Greece, in the 1950s or American Graffiti or something like that. You know, is the idiot kid that works in the grease monkey that works in the auto shop, who's got a limited vocabulary and is impressed by things, and people will say, you know, yeah, overhead manifold flange bracket to him, and he'll go, oh yeah, I know all about engines. And he'll say something, and it doesn't understand. They were stealth,
stealth. Here's the thing, is that he's been briefed on this. He's the fucking president. So he's been briefed on how it went. Yeah. He likely was in the situation room when it was happening. He was probably at least tangentially involved in the planning of it, probably okayed it at least.
Yeah, this is what we're going to do. Don't ask
certainly, We're certainly briefed on what the mission was going to be and then on how it went and all of that stuff.
Yeah.
So he's been given information. But he doesn't listen.
No.
He doesn't take in information. He certainly doesn't read the brief that he's given
and
he
doesn't understand it.
So of all of that stuff, the single fact he said was that the planes flew for 37 hours.
Yeah.
The rest of it is just bluster.
Yeah.
There isn't a single other thing in there which is information. About anything. And he's being asked about the mission.
Yeah.
And none of that is information that would be useful to a person who wanted to know anything about the mission.
And when he has bragged about what's going on, of course, he's revealed all of the plans ahead of time.
Yeah, sure.
You know, so he makes no distinction between top secret stuff and stuff that's too boring to actually take in, and you know, it's obviously unimportant, so he will just blether either of those two. There's a word, blether. He will talk about either of those. He doesn't understand that one of them's top secret.
His life is a book report on a book he hasn't read.
Yeah. yes.
So we do have some social contestants
right
on Facebook. Andrew says, I think this is a general saying, sir, too far. Number two has to be fake.
Right.
Yeah,
that was one of the triggers for me.
Trigger for you.
And the 2-3-4 days. Yeah.
Yeah. Fennec says, blimey, Jim, you've done it again. I'm guessing number one is fake because of the attempt to define skedaddle. It means skedaddle.
Brexit means Brexit. Yeah. Yeah.
on Patreon.
Yeah.
Richard says, it's got to be one that's fake news, which makes me a bit sad because I would love to hear the human embodiment of the slippery slope fallacy say that. One is well worthy of stand-up, though. Third job, Jim.
Yeah. Yeah.
One-Eyed Nick says, fuck me, that's painful to read. The President, I know what I wrote, talking about starting a war like it's one of his imaginary golf drives, but I struggle to believe even he's dumb enough to say the word skedaddle means to skedaddle. Well, I can, but it's as good a reason as any to choose an answer. I'm saying one is fake.
Wow. Ooh, nice. Yeah. Well, you've properly foxed them.
The Pizza Dude Chronicles on TikTok says, I think the one Jim made up is the one that he wrote, and out of these three, I think it's obviously one of them.
Yeah.
And,
nice.
And finally, Anders says, number three is fake. I don't think he thinks planes are beautiful. And skedaddle, come on, I can go along with him saying it in number one and number two, but three times over, come on.
Yeah. Well, that's it. Yeah, as you see, you were a bit stealth with the thing.
Yeah.
The sir tell. Yeah.
I'm going to have to include more where he says, because he says sir for people saying stuff to him all the time.
Yeah.
So I just need to include a few of those where that's the real one.
Yeah. And then put one that's utterly outrageous. And people just go, well, that's clearly the one. And I seem to recall that was my strategy when our roles were reversed.
Yeah.
Was to put one that was outrageously Boris Johnson.
It worked.
And it worked.
Absolutely.
It
worked.
Hid the other one. Yeah.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting six crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus four biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
And it's time for the part of the show that this week, at least, because it had to be, is called The Epstein Files Are Not a Logical Fallacy. Because, holy shit, this has been...
So good, isn't it?
I mean, the thing is, there's a lot to this story. There's such a lot to this story. We're not going to be able to talk about it all. And we're probably not going to be able to talk about it in order of when it happened or importance or any of that stuff. This is going to be a little bit of a mess because this story is a mess.
Yeah.
Because it's been, I mean, we've been,
well, let's hope
be
it
fair,
runs and runs.
It's been about a month since we recorded an episode last time.
And it's been going along constantly, isn't it?
Yeah. Because this is a story that Trump thought would go away like every single other thing that has been bad about him has just gone away. Because he said stuff about it and his allies have said, oh, this is fine, don't worry about it. And people have moved on because there's been another different scandal. But the difference with this one is, it seems, or the main one of the main differences is this is a big part of why he's president.
Exactly.
Is because the QAnon lot, and including many members of his administration, including the ones who are
in charge of
in place
FBI.
Responsible for the Epstein files, like Pam Bondi and Cash Patel and Dan Bongino, spent the previous several years talking about how this was a major scandal and a huge issue that only could possibly be resolved by electing Trump, and then he would release all of the details and we'd finally find out what was going on, and all the people who were responsible would be brought to justice, and the Democrats who were undoubtedly part of Epstein's client list.
Arrests would will be made.
Yeah, there'd be public arrests and executions, and that would be amazing. So they built so much of their personality around it.
Yeah.
That first of all, the Cash Patel and Dan Bongino and Pam Bondi saying, yeah, it's nothing. It's actually, it's fine. Yeah, don't worry about it.
Yeah, nothing.
That didn't work.
No.
And then when people are saying, no, this is actually important, we care about it, him coming out saying, God, are people still talking about this? Yeah. That also didn't work.
Yeah, yeah.
So, people are still fucking talking about it.
And then saying, what we'll do, we'll get Ghislaine Maxwell to go talk to them. And then mysteriously she gets moved.
So many things have just made it worse.
Yeah.
Yeah, but as I said, we won't do it in order. So the Ghislaine Maxwell stuff is some of the most recent stuff. But Todd Blanche, Trump's deputy attorney general and former personal lawyer,
Yeah.
Spent a couple of days talking to Ghislaine Maxwell, supposedly giving her limited immunity for that conversation, which isn't unusual. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's well, let me clarify. Giving a prisoner limited immunity to talk more about their crimes in ways that you hope will implicate other people you can then take to court isn't unusual.
Right.
The way this was done was every bit fucking unusual. Because first of all, the deputy AG going on their own to talk to a prisoner is ridiculous. That definitely doesn't happen. If anyone from the Attorney General's office does do that, there is an FBI agent present.
Right.
If someone from the Federal Attorney General's office goes to talk to a federal prisoner, an FBI agent is present during that interview. And the reason for that is because although that prisoner may have been given immunity, that immunity or limited immunity, that immunity is for things they say during that interview, then cannot be used in court as evidence to convict them of other crimes.
Right.
But the things they say can lead to other investigations that can end up in implicating them in other crimes, and it can lead to other people being implicated in crimes. So those conversations may well end up being referred to in court. And you need a witness to say what was said, because otherwise one of the lawyers there, either Ghislaine Maxwell's lawyer or Todd Blanche in this case, or you know, the Attorney General's, someone from the Attorney General's office, is being the witness, and that doesn't work. Lawyers can't be the witnesses in the cases that they're bringing or defending. That fucks everything up. So you have an FBI agent in the room, so they can be the witness to the things that were said in the room.
Right.
No FBI agent was in the room for this. It was Ghislaine Maxwell, her lawyer, and Todd Blanche. And the reason for that is this wasn't a fact-finding mission. This wasn't an interview where they were getting information from her that could be used to implicate other people or find it or do further investigation. Mm-hmm. This was, I mean, to all appearances, was a meeting where she was being told, if you know anything about Trump, don't fucking say anything about Trump. Otherwise, you'll be in more trouble. And if you don't, if you say Trump was innocent of anything, then maybe we can help you out a bit. And the reason that it appears like that is because she was, within days, moved to a minimum security facility.
Yeah.
Which is not a thing you're allowed to do for sex offenders. They had to had to waive her sex offender status to allow her to be moved to this facility. Because you're not allowed to be there. That's just how that works. Because ideally keep the sex offenders away from society while they're being incarcerated, which the minimum security facility doesn't really do. It allows people out on day release and all kinds of things like that. So she's not even allowed to participate in the dog training that some prisoners can do in that facility because of her crimes that she committed, because they're like, I don't want this person to be around my animals. So that's like, you know, that's how much they trust her. And yet the government has given her this move into a very cushy prison compared to the one she was in.
Mm-hmm.
Also, since her meeting with Todd Blanche, it has been reported that she said Trump didn't do anything concerning when I was around.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, nothing to write home about.
Yeah,
which is, of course, exactly what you expect her to say. There's also the fact that she repeatedly perjured herself during her own trial. She maintains that she never did anything wrong, and she never saw Jeffrey Epstein do anything wrong.
Yeah.
So there's no reason to believe anything she says at all anyway.
Yes.
The only reason for Trump's former personal lawyer and current deputy AG to talk to her, for her to be moved, and for anyone to know anything that was said in that room is so that she can theoretically make Trump look innocent. No one believes it.
Yeah.
No. Bullshit. Obviously bullshit. So all that's been done is huge sex trafficker has been given essentially an easier sentence to do. I mean, we don't know if she's there permanently and then in the lower security facility, but it seems like it. No reason to assume she isn't.
Yeah.
There's also obviously been a lot of talk about whether he could pardon her, or whether he will pardon her. Again, if she were happy to come out and say, like, I'll swear under oath, perfectly happy to perjure herself again. I'll swear under oath that Trump was never anywhere near any underage people at all anytime I saw him anywhere near Epstein. And then, yeah, a pardon may be on the table. He's said, he hasn't said he's considering it, but he said he's able to do it. He would be able to.
Within his powers.
When people have asked, he hasn't said, no, I'm obviously not going to do that. She's a terrible woman. He said, I could do it if I wanted to. So yeah, that's terrible. That's a really fucking awful thing.
And it's got, of course, if he's putting that on the table, because he's entirely transactional, you know, I will do something for you if you'll do something for me, because he thinks he's a mafia don.
Yep.
And it, just about that. It's that kind of, I'll waive this. Yes, I could do something. It's in my power to do that. Yeah, rather than having some integrity to say, no, she's been party to heinous, awful things that even he said, yeah, we threw the guy out when he didn't. We threw him out when he did. When he was
be
doing
fair,
stuff with...
His story on that keeps changing. Stephen Chung, the White House Communications Director, has said that Epstein was thrown out of... His membership was rescinded or whatever for being a creep.
Yeah.
But that's not what Trump has said in the past or has said most recently. His most recent claim of why they parted ways is because Epstein was stealing young women from him.
From his
which
employee.
Is a fucking creepy way to put it.
But
supposedly that Epstein, who doesn't incidentally have a club, was stealing Trump's employees from his club. And that, because he did it once and Trump said, oi, don't do that. And then he did it again. That was why he wasn't allowed to be around Mar-a-Lago anymore. Which is a worse story. It's a much better story. If you're like, I had reports of inappropriate behavior and I said that we can't have that at all. That's right out. And got rid of him. But that's not what he's saying happened. It is weird that they aren't talking about what further steps they can take. It seems like the whole investigation is over. Like the book is closed on the Epstein investigation as a whole. And while I actually believe the claims of Pam Bondi now, not the claims she made in I think it was March, maybe, when she said she had the Epstein client list on her desk and was getting ready to release it, but the one she makes now, which is that there isn't an Epstein client
list.
I believe that in the sense that I don't think Epstein probably kept a list of his clients. It's possible. It's possible he had some kind of blackmail material. According to Michael Wolff, the author who's written about Trump extensively, when he met with Epstein, Epstein had photos in his safe of Trump with topless, young-looking women.
Mm-hmm.
So it's possible that he had blackmail material against people and possibly even had a list somewhere. But even though there may well not and probably wasn't ever a specific client list written down on paper...
Mm.
That doesn't mean the FBI don't have a list of people
of
who were
clients. Yes. Yeah.
Because they do have a shit ton of videos that he had and his financial records and other data that was seized from his, you know, his house on his private island and his office in New York and various other places and his house in Palm Beach as well. Places that he definitely had information and had stuff and there was evidence of people he was interacting with who would be people who you could investigate and there would be things to look into.
Yeah.
Of course, there are people who the FBI suspect may have been involved in some of the stuff that Epstein was doing.
Yep.
The sex trafficking that Ghislaine Maxwell is in prison for was trafficking those people to have sex with someone.
Yeah, but because Trump has, a bit like I said about Boris, you know, if the system doesn't allow a narcissistic Machiavellian creep to go in to get anywhere near power, what you do is change the system. So what Trump has done is he's manipulated his way into this position of power in order to avoid and populate all of the stations of of offices with his sycophants, such that he can't be tracked down for any, he can't be held accountable for anything.
Yeah, because he controls what they do. He
controls the justice system. He controls the FBI.
A realistic theory as to why information is, why the investigation appears to have been shut down and why that information isn't being released, is that Trump is in those lists.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yep. He's obviously very, very clearly in the Epstein files, whether he is involved in illegal activity or not, because he was a friend of and associate of Epstein's for a long time. He's on the flight lists that are public of flying on Epstein's private plane.
Yeah.
Multiple times. He may possibly have never visited the island, but he's certainly been to Epstein's house and office, and Epstein went to Mar-a-Lago multiple times.
Yeah.
There are reliable reports of parties where it was just Trump and Epstein and a number of young women.
Yeah.
He's definitely in there. Whether there is evidence among the stuff the FBI have of Epstein's that implicates Trump in crimes, we don't know. But they're releasing nothing. And the thing you can guarantee is that if there were people like Bill Gates or Bill Clinton or George Soros or people that they continually say are in the Epstein client list, if there was evidence that implicated those people, you can pretty much guarantee Kash Patel would be fucking releasing that information very quickly.
Yeah,
I don't believe he's hiding that stuff. That's crazy. The stuff that they released earlier in the year when they said, we're being transparent, was actually mostly redacted stuff of stuff that's already public. And at this point, when people are saying, okay, release more of the information you have, they're just not. They're just saying, there's nothing to look at. It's very boring.
The only thing that's going to
we have,
the only thing that's going to derail this is the MAGA base saying, okay, where are the files that you three MAGA people who are now in charge of the very offices that you said were hiding this stuff? Where is that stuff? The MAGA chickens are coming home to roost. It's that kind of, they are at the mercy of conspiracy theories. They're feeling it from the other side now. So Kash Patel is on the receiving end of conspiracy theories, and nothing he can say because we know that nothing anybody else said would change his mind. So it's going to continue to be the case. He's now there saying, well, there is nothing, and people are just going to say, well, we don't believe you. The thing is, he could do all of these things, like take Ghislaine Maxwell off somewhere, pardon her, you know, ask questions, basically say, yeah, don't say anything about Trump or things will be bad for you. Do all of that publicly, move her somewhere else. Nobody's going to be able to hold them to account for that because he's got the Supreme Court sewn up. That's the depressingly awful thing. So the only thing that will topple it is his mad, deranged MAGA base, who are having to go through, you know, 1,000 triple Selcos with a double pike and a back somersault in order to explain the fact that their God King isn't doing what they said he was going to, and JFK isn't risen from the grave, and all of those things that we read about on QAnon.
I mean, people are, depending on who it is on the right, they are taking different approaches to whether they should side with him or argue against him, sometimes different on just like consecutive days. But people like Charlie Kirk, for instance, initially, like straight away was, oh, this is terrible, we need to know more about it, we need to get the files released. And then once Trump was saying, look, you know, can't believe people are still talking about it, he said, I'm done talking about this, I'm going to trust my friends in the administration. I'm done talking about this for now. And then there was backlash against that. And then the next day he came out and said, when I said for now, I meant like yesterday. I'm going to talk more about it today. And so they're basically kind of feeling their way through to what extent they can side with Trump or like not completely disavow Trump and claim that this is some other kind of 5D chess that he's doing that means that they can explain what all this is about. And then you've got people like Lauren Boebert, who suggested that they get a special prosecutor on this, to investigate the Epstein thing. And the person she suggested they should appoint as special prosecutor is Matt Gaetz, who at least, you know, he is somewhat of an expert in the trafficking of underage women for sex. So
that would qualify him.
Sure.
Yeah. Wouldn't have to get up to speed. Yeah.
No, absolutely.
Yeah.
Republicans who were asked recently, if it was like officially stated that Trump was involved in illicit activity, like illegal stuff with Epstein, would that change your vote? Would you not vote for him? Would you vote for another party?
Yeah.
58% of over 55 Republicans, like older Republicans, said, no, wouldn't change my vote.
Yeah.
They would still vote for him, even if it came out officially that he was involved in essentially sex trafficking or paedophilia.
Yeah.
Among Republicans as a whole, it was under 50, but it was still frighteningly high. It was in the 40s, I think, percent.
Wow.
And so it is one of those things that we've kind of always known this. There are some members of his base there's literally nothing that could possibly make them not vote for him.
Yeah.
They are absolutely on the Trump train and that's it.
Yeah.
But this does, for some people, move the needle on whether they might consider him their God King for anymore if this isn't resolved in a way that makes them happy. And the way that you can tell that this is perhaps a bigger thing than we've ever really seen that might do that is the fact that we're still talking about it. It's not Democrats keeping this in the media.
Yeah.
I mean, the Democrats are doing that because it's an opportunity to capitalize on the fact that something isn't going well for Trump, which is always useful. And, you know, Democrats in Congress have tried to vote on getting the Epstein files released and Republicans voted against releasing them and then shut down Congress a week early for the August shutdown so that they didn't have to keep talking about it. That looks bad for them, in my opinion, and it looks good for Democrats. But the fact that this is still a thing and it's still being talked about on the right and by right-wing pundits, and they're saying he's not doing the right thing and he shouldn't keep coming out and saying, you know, this is not a big deal, don't worry about it, because to them it is a big deal.
Well, yeah, that and the fact that he is going to reduce prices by 12,000%. So,
numbers that don't even seem realistic, he said, something like that.
So, meanwhile, you know, they're ordinary voters who said he was going to bring down the price of eggs and are paying more for eggs than they were before are convinced that that it was all Biden's fault.
Yeah.
And believe
there's a huge amount that they can rationalize. And it's only last year when people were saying, not many people, but kind of 5 to 10% of Republicans were saying that if he was convicted of felonies, they wouldn't be able to vote for him.
Yeah.
They were either lying at the time when they said that.
Yeah.
Or they underestimated their ability to rationalize their behavior.
Yep.
Because they still voted for him. They voted for him in the same kinds of numbers as they did 4 years before.
Yeah.
And it didn't really have the impact that we thought maybe it would have. Because even like at that time, before the last election, I was saying, I don't think it's going to have a huge impact, but it only needs to impact 3 or 4% of them.
Yeah.
It only needs to have that. And he was convicted of 34 felonies with months to go before the election. And I was like, maybe it's enough just to convince a few percent. And that's really all we need. And it wasn't. It didn't.
Nope.
It didn't change their behavior, even the ones who said it would. And so with this, it feels like something that they're saying, this is it. I can't continue to support him. But I kind of feel, give it another year, because midterms are more than a year away, and they'll either, maybe some of them, maybe a few of them will have moved away from MAGA, but I think the vast majority of them will probably be like, yeah I can actually make myself okay with it.
Yeah, it's got all the makings of a religion. You kind of think, you know, in 2,000 years' time, there'll be a Trump religion because it's that blind.
Don't think it'll take anywhere near that long.
No. It's only took 4 years. Yeah. It is a blind faith.
Yes.
It's because he's not of this world, not of this realm. Anything he does in this corporeal shell is fine. You know, he's got our best interests at heart, even though he's exploiting the fuck out of everybody he ever comes in contact with. We're fine with that because somehow...
Because it's hurting the people we hate.
Yeah.
Yes, it hurts us a bit. But the people we hate are really hurting.
Yeah, yeah.
So, yeah, we can live with it. So
we can live with that.
That's all I can make it make sense as their rationale.
Yeah.
Is that they're okay with it because they're filled with hate. And
well, it's the entire exploitation of the Europhobes, the Eurosceptics, you know, the disenfranchised racists. Let's empower the people that hate foreigners to change the system so that I could become the prime minister. I don't have to deliver on anything that I've come up with. I just need to get into power. What I'll do is make it the people's struggle, and then I will stand at the front and declare that I am their savior. And finally, some things we really don't have time to talk about.
Back in 95 BC, Tigran the Great was king of Armenia. He pissed off the Romans by helping one of their enemies, and when a Roman general marched on Armenia, a messenger was sent to warn the king. Tigran didn't want to hear that, so he had the messenger beheaded. From that point on, nobody gave Tigran any bad news, and the wars he was involved in went very badly because he didn't have good intel. If only Trump was a scholar of the classics like good old Boris Johnson, he might have learned from Tigran's mistakes. But instead, he fired the commissioner of the Bureau of Labor Statistics last month because he didn't like the job numbers they reported. On Truth Social, he claimed that the commissioner, Erica Meckenthaler, rigged the numbers to make Trump look bad. And when he was asked about it by reporters, he also said, "Days before the election, she came out with these beautiful numbers for Kamala, I guess Biden Kamala, and she came out with these beautiful numbers trying to get somebody else elected." Which is weird, because when the job report came out on November 1st last year, showing a very modest 12,000 new jobs in October, Trump called it a catastrophe and said, "It definitely reveals how badly Kamala Harris broke our economy." He also claimed that right after the election, she revised the previous job numbers down by 800,000 or 900,000. But this actually happened in August, 10 weeks before the election. I'm sure Trump's remaining department heads have got the message now that he only wants to hear good news. Frankly, I'm surprised any of them were still under the impression that the truth was important to him.
Ryan Walters, Oklahoma's culture warrior superintendent of public instruction, is a self-avowed opponent of pornography in education, so much so that he's accused schools of pushing pornography for containing decidedly non-pornographic books like The Kite Runner by Khaled Hosseini and The Glass Castle by Jeanette Walls. Imagine our surprise/delight when in the closed-door portion of a Board of Education meeting last week, whilst a parent discussed appealing a district transfer denial, two board members, Becky Carson and Ryan Detheridge, noticed a video on the screen in Walters' office was displaying a video featuring multiple nude women and some sort of chiropractic table. Whilst a little concerned, both board members did seem to reveal some familiarity with the pornography genre, sufficient to be able to describe the footage as retro and did not feature intercourse. "Turn it off now," Becky Carson recalls saying. Walters asked, "What is this? What is this?" and fumbled to turn it off while saying, "I can't get it to turn off. I can't figure out how to turn it off." This is not the first time Walters is accused of subjecting unsuspecting Oklahoma lawmakers to porn. In March 2023, he emailed several pornographic images to state legislators claiming he was supplying them with evidence they'd requested of inappropriate material in Oklahoma schools. But lawmakers on both sides of the aisle were left confused, as the email was entirely devoid of context, containing no mention of schools that allegedly had the material. Walters' response to this new incident has been all but graceful. A spokesman told Nondoc their story was a junk tabloid lie, telling a reporter to get a job at a different independent publication and let us know when you're going to write a real story. Waltz has claimed on X Twitter, I have no knowledge of what was on the TV screen during the alleged incident, and there is absolutely no truth or any implication of wrongdoing. They aren't just attacking me, they're attacking the values of the Oklahomans who elected me to challenge the status quo. Yeah, because if Oklahoma wanted you to challenge the status quo of not showing porn during board meetings, then way to go. If the challenge is to stamp out pornography in the state education system, then this, and identifying the kite runner as pornographic, kind of suggests you don't really know what you're doing.
While Elon Musk is no longer working at the Department of Government Efficiency, somehow it still exists, and some of the people he brought in are still part of the fake government agency named after a meme coin. Some of those engineers were responsible for coding an AI tool that's being used to slash federal regulations. There are about 200,000 federal regulations, apparently, and according to a PowerPoint presentation obtained by the Washington Post, DOGE reckons they can get rid of about 50% of them. How do they estimate 50% without even reading them, let alone trying to figure out why they exist in the first place? Fuck you, that's how. Cutting regulations is a core part of Trump's goals because regulations make it harder for billionaires to make more money, and the only people they protect are consumers and workers. And according to the American Action Forum, a center-right think tank that tracks regulations, during the first 6 months of Trump's second term, his administration cut regulatory costs by about $550 million and paperwork hours by 566,000. However, they also note that nearly all of the cost reductions are due to repealing one rule regarding what businesses have to report about their ownership ties. Without that, regulatory costs would have increased under Trump by $1.1 billion and paperwork hours by $3.3 million. So it's going great, and at least we know that AI tools coded by Musk's engineers are definitely reliable and not at all prone to fascism. In related news, Musk got frustrated last month that his AI chatbot, Grok, kept disagreeing with him because it was basing too many of its answers on objective reality. So he tweaked the code to turn down the wokeness, and within 3 days it was calling itself Mecha Hitler and posting violent rape fantasies about Democratic political candidates. Some people see this as a bad thing, but evidently not Pete Hegseth, as a week later, the Department of Defense awarded a $200 million contract to XAI and announced the Pentagon would be using Grok. Suddenly, it all makes a lot more sense. I thought the Hitler praise and violent rhetoric was an unintended byproduct of telling Grok to ignore reality. But now we know they were auditioning for far-right Fox and Friends weekend host Pete Hegseth. It's clear that Grok was just showing him what it was capable of.
Hurricane season is almost upon the US, and the National Weather Service, which Elon Musk's Doge experiment in some sort of attempt to hold back the sea Canute style and make good on Trump's implied promise of nothing but blue skies from now on, slashed by 550-odd staff, has received permission to hire 450 meteorologists, hydrologists, and radar technicians. The NWS had been arguing for months for a public safety exemption for the federal hiring freeze, and that exemption has been granted, and the agency is now direct hiring authority for filling vacancies when a critical hiring need or severe shortage of candidates exists. Agency employees are greeting the news unveiled at an all-hands meeting on Monday with guarded optimism and relief. Current employees will be working additional hours trying to maintain the 24/7 posture US extreme weather requires. One National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration official also expressed some frustration in that relief. How much time and money is it going to cost to train a bunch of new people when we had already trained people in place? Yeah, you know, the kind of inefficient practices in government that Musk was tasked to wheedle out. Thank goodness Trump's administration is completely different from Biden's pointlessly wasteful administration.
The White House has announced that construction will soon begin on a new ballroom, which Donald is very excited about because building pointless vulgar monuments to his greatness is much more fun than trying to actually improve the lives of Americans. The architect's renderings are in, and it's exactly as gaudy as you expect, which is as gaudy as fuck. If you haven't seen them, just picture any square foot of the Oval Office, not the Oval Office you've seen in films, the new and improved one with gold spray-painted polystyrene superglued to every conceivable surface. Got that image in your head? Okay, now just extrapolate that out to a 90,000 square foot room. You might have trouble picturing a room that size without context, so it might help if I tell you that the entire White House is 55,000 square feet.
Yes, it's a single room almost twice as large as the whole building the executive branch works out of every day. Unnecessarily large, you say? Not so. It's totally necessary, actually, because, you see, the White House isn't able to host large events because the current largest room is the East Room, which only has a seating capacity of 200. According to the official announcement, the seating capacity in this new ballroom will be 650. I haven't been able to find anyone reporting on this aspect of it at all, but the math is, in my opinion, a little off. The East Room is just under 3,000 square feet. That's about 15 square feet per person, which is roughly the space you get in a fine dining restaurant. With 650 people in a 90,000 square foot ballroom, each person gets 138 square feet. That's almost 12 feet between you and the person sitting next to you. Trump claims this hasn't been done before because no previous president knew how to build a ballroom. But I'm pretty sure most previous presidents at least knew how to math. Or maybe they just all had wives and friends who were prepared to spend time within 12 feet of them.
Uber Karen and man whose face is made of the marshmallows that fall into the fire, Alan Dershowitz, has been continuing to make his sour self and the grievances he feels a result of what the world thinks of him everybody else's problem. Notwithstanding his fine, upright, loyally standing alongside the likes of Rudy Giuliani in defending the indefensible, Donald Trump, O.J. Simpson, Jeffrey Epstein, Harvey Weinstein, and Klaus von Bülow, Dershowitz wearing a T-shirt with Proud American Zionist on it at the West Tisbury Farmer Market at Martha's Vineyard got the attention of Krem Miskovich, who runs the Good Pierogi stall there. Sufficient for them to exercise the right to refuse customers of their choosing, as the police officer could be heard saying when he asked Dershowitz to stop blocking the stall so other customers could be served. Calling this act of proprietorial discretion pure McCarthyism, yep, that's how much of a cultural and historical scholar he is, Dershowitz showed up at Miskovich's stand against the following week in what he called an effort to try to restore community in the interest of keeping the island together. Because, yeah, it's all falling apart through lack of your effort, Alan, mate. He arrived bearing an autographed copy of his book, 10 Big Anti-Israel Lies and How to Refute Them with the Truth, inscribed to Krem, please learn the truth, and offer the vendor an opportunity to at least at last sell him some pierogi and show that you're prepared to sell to anybody and not allow your anti-Zionism to decide which people you'll sell to. Krem didn't sell him any. And a large crowd that had come out to support Miskovich chanting time to go led once again to Dershowitz being escorted away. Dershowitz then ranted on his best Dr. Jacoby fashion on his YouTube channel while sporting a farmer's market T-shirt to hide the blackness of his heart when supporting his fellow man, and threatened legal action against the farmer's market to ensure that they only have booze that will sell to everybody and don't allow booze that discriminate on the basis of race, gender, religion or politics. Despite saying, I don't think I've ever seen a place that is as intolerant as Martha's Vineyard, he's apparently been vacationing there for 50 years, and yet previously has had a shouting match with Larry David on the porch of the Chilmark General Store, and complained that the library won't stock his books, which he said is losing me friends, and my wife, who doesn't agree with what I've done and said, is losing friends. Perhaps, Alan, you should either heed the advice of the director of the library and realise that you're retired, enjoy it, or seek some from the likes of Peter Crone, the mind architect, who might begin by holding up a mirror and asking how it would be if the world is just fine and it's all in your head. The next thing that pops up in my YouTube feed after Alan and Peter, delightfully, was top five times Karen's got instant karma. Sometimes the universe is sending messages.
I think it's important to note that the Proud American Zionist T-shirt is Dershowitz's idea of why he was not served a pierogi. That's his claim, and he wasn't wearing it while not being served a pierogi.
Right.
Good pierogi people didn't serve him because of who he is, because of him and his individual, because he's an awful, awful man who associates himself with awful, awful people.
Awful people.
And they quite rightly went, I don't have to serve you. I'm not going to serve you. He said that he has previously worn a Proud American Zionist T-shirt at the farmer's market, and no doubt
and people have still served him.
Yeah. That was that the reason that the fact they must have seen him in the past means they're anti-Zionist and that's why they wouldn't serve him.
Wow.
It's anti-religion thing. But and that's also, absolutely not the reason. It's because of the awful individual that he is, regardless of any protected classes he might be a member of.
Yeah. And also he's said that he's been to other places and despite all these horrible heinous criminals that he's representative, they've had no problem serving him.
Yeah.
And you go, yeah. Wonder what those places were. Gun shops? I don't know. Ku Klux Klan outfitters? I don't know.
Yeah. One thing I'm very happy to say is that in the week following this happening, Good Pierogi did extremely well. They did very good business at that farmer's market.
Yeah.
Lots of people turned out to patronise that stall.
Fantastic.
Back in January, Trump issued an executive order cancelling birthright citizenship. Multiple judges pointed out you can't just erase the 14th Amendment with an executive order and blocked it going into effect. And then in June, the Supreme Court ruled that federal district judges can't issue nationwide injunctions. They can only give relief to specific plaintiffs with standing to sue. Naturally, Trump declared victory despite the Supreme Court not making any ruling on the birthright citizenship issue itself, but he figured his troubles were over. You can kind of forgive Trump for thinking that judges aren't smart, since he's gone out of his way to only appoint judges who either don't understand the law or are willing to overlook it if it benefits their political ambition. However, many judges are smart, and so far, four have managed to block the executive order despite the Supreme Court's ruling. The first was in New Hampshire, where US District Judge Joseph LaPlante, a Bush appointee, granted class action status to a lawsuit challenging the order and made all babies born in the US members of the class.
Wow.
The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals then ruled that a nationwide injunction was the narrowest possible way to provide relief for the four Democratic states who sued the administration because people move around a lot. So if the injunction didn't also cover the states where people were born or later moved to, they could still suffer irreparable harm. A Massachusetts judge used the same reasoning to uphold the injunction he issued in February. And just last week, a Maryland judge certified another class action saying, "The court finds that the only way to afford complete relief to the certified class is to enjoin enforcement of the executive order as to each member of the class. That relief must include every child in the United States who is subject to the executive order." Legal solutions take a long time and much damage can be done during the delay, but cases like these and others are still working their way through the courts, and at least some of the time we'll be able to prevent bad things happening. Not as much as I'd like, but sometimes you have to take wins where you can.
Yeah. News appeared this week in the UK that in March, Labour's Minister for Homelessness, Roshanar Ali, served notice on four tenants renting her East London property. Ali is the minister in charge of tackling evictions, rising rents and insecure housing, basically in charge of fighting for renters' rights. Labour's election campaign promised to clamp down on no-fault evictions, skyrocketing rents, landlords gaming the system and letting agents breaking the law. The MP evicted the tenants, no misconduct, no rent arrears, just a Section 21 no-fault eviction. The tenants were then offered rolling contracts, but only temporarily while the property was listed for sale. When no buyer emerged, it was quietly put back on the rental market, now at £4,000 a month, £700 more than before. New tenants then moved in. What happened to the old tenants? They were hit with charges, including £2,000 for repainting and £395 for cleaning. Both charges are banned under the Tenant Fees Act 2019. After the tenants revealed their landlord was a sitting MP, the letting agents backed off and dropped the charges. Home Secretary Yvette Cooper, whilst declaring she doesn't know any of the details, defended Ali, saying she followed all the rules. Far be it from me to reductio ad Hitlerum, but the optics are a bit redolent of "I was just following orders." Thank goodness Labour are so much more different from the visibly corrupt Tories. Meanwhile, 600,000 odd people have signed up to Jeremy Corbyn's new political movement called Your Party, positioned as a left-wing alternative. The knives are out already, not from the right wing. They're too busy fending off or absorbing what's left of Farage's policies after Starmer has apparently hoovered most of them up. No, of course not. It's the Labour Party themselves who dismissed Corbyn as a personality politician. Well, I guess when you're styling a party of drony-voiced middle managers, Oh, and finding an excuse to oust something of a personality and mother of the House vocal campaigner Diane Abbott again, meek and mild yet principled socialist Corbyn could indeed look like a superstar. Everybody, to the tune of Seven Nation Army, you know what to do.
So that's all the bad arguments and faulty reasoning we have time for this week. You'll find the show notes at fallacioustrump.com. And if you hear Trump say something stupid and want to ask if it's a fallacy, our contact details are on the contact page.
If you think we've used a fallacy ourselves, let us know. And if you've had a good time, please give us a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts, or simply tell one other person in person about how much they'd like our podcast. And you can support the show at patreon.com/ftrump, just like our newest patron, Flern. Our straw man level patrons, Chuck Gray, Mike Smith, LT, Colleen Lyella, Richard Thunder Hopkins, Will M. Scott, Mark Reike, and Amber R. Buchanan, who told us when we met her at QED, we just called her Amber. And last year at QED, I met the listener who recognised at QED the year before because we keep using her full name all the time. And our true Scotsman level patrons, Renee Z, Melissa Sitek, Stephen Bickle, Janet Uezza, Andrew Houck, and our top patron, Kaz Tui. Welcome aboard, Flern, and thank you everybody else for your continued support. It's very, very much appreciated.
You can connect with those awesome people as well as us and other listeners in the Facebook group at facebook.com/group/fallacioustrump or in the Discord at fallacioustrump.com/discord.
All music was by The Outburst and was used with permission, so until next time on Fallacious Trump, we'll leave the last word to the Donald.
That's right, go home to mommy. Bye. Bye!
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.